You're listening to another podcast. A podcast not only of reviewing and discussing, but of discovery. A deep dive into a classic show whose influence is immeasurable. Your next stop, Anthology.
Hello and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and if this is your first time listening, Anthology is a podcast where I review The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer and other classic and contemporary science fiction anthology series. For archives of all of my episodes, visit AnthologyPod.com. You can also like the Facebook page at Facebook.com/AnthologyPod and follow me on Twitter at OVAnthologyPod. And of course, you can also email me at Matt@ObsessiveViewer.com. And if you'd like to support what I do here, you can become a patron at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer, where depending on what tier you join at, you can get exclusive B-roll episodes, TV and book reviews, movie reaction recordings, commentary tracks, Patreon potpourri, early access to podcast episodes. There is a ton of content on there, and I have lofty goals for the rest of the year and into next year as well. So if you like hearing the sound of my voice and want to hear more of it, you can sign up on Patreon to get much more stuff. Today on the show, I'm going to be discussing A Piano in the House. It is the 22nd episode of The Twilight Zone's third season, and it originally aired on February 16th, 1962, and I'll be rounding out the episode with a brief review of Science Fiction Theater Season 1, Episode 29, The Hastings Secret. But before I get into all of that, I want to share some news and updates and stuff. I'm going to borrow Truman Bradley's kind of sign off on science fiction theater and say that I'm going to be sharing some news and stuff from the world of fiction and science. So I've got a couple of things and a couple of sales pitches to throw to you. So really the one big news item I have is Rob Delaney was recently cast in Black Mirror Season 6. We still don't have a release date or anything for Season 6. We don't have any other real details about it. No idea how many episodes it's going to be. All we know is that it's going to be more than three. And the cast is, the casting announcements are getting exciting each time they get a new casting announcement out. I'm pretty excited to see what happens. So I'll put a link in the show notes for more information about Rob Delaney's casting. And then in terms of sci-fi stuff that I've been doing, it's been pretty busy at Obsessive Viewer Studios, aka my apartment. So over on Patreon, this is what I mean by the soft pitch to you guys or the hard pitch to you guys, but Patreon. I mentioned it before. So to kind of talk a little bit more in depth about that, on Patreon, I have a lot of content on there. It's across all three of my podcasts. This one, Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies. Basically, you sign up at a certain tier level, and judging from what tier level you're on, that's what the content you get is. So if you sign on at the $1 level, you get B-roll episodes. That's just kind of us, kind of me and my co-hosts and friends and guests and everything on podcast episodes, just kind of riffing and talking and kind of just having casual conversations. That's at the $1 level. Plus you get early access to podcast episodes, which means that basically as soon as I finish editing an episode, I throw it on Patreon and then I schedule it to go on the main feed. Sometimes that can be days in advance. Sometimes it can be hours. Sometimes it can be at the same time, but I do give early access to Patreon. But the $2 level is the big one. $2 level is where I have a bunch of TV and book reviews and reaction recordings and everything. So I recently did an immediate reaction recording for Clerks 3, which I got a screener of. It's a terrible, terrible movie. I really hated it. It's the worst movie I've seen of this year. And you can hear me rant about it. I also wrote a review on ObsessiveViewer.com. But then also, I've been doing episode reviews of Dark on Netflix. Dark, if you're listening to this and you like science fiction, I highly recommend watching Dark. It's a German sci-fi series that's all about kind of a group of people in a community in a small town who As the series progresses, I'm five episodes in, as the series progresses, it has some time travel-y stuff going on, and it is very spectacular. I'm really enjoying it. I've been doing episode-by-episode reviews of it, so I've been... If you want to dive into a sci-fi show with me that's not The Twilight Zone, I recommend checking out Patreon at the $2 level, because I'm going hard with those reviews. I spend about an hour just talking out my feelings on it, because it is a very spectacular science fiction show. So check that out. And I have a bunch of other stuff on the $2 level, but the $5 level has all of that plus movie commentary tracks and Patreon potpourri, which is what I call just a grouping together of reviews that I put together kind of on a theme. So I recently did a Spielberg sci-fi episode where I talked about my feelings about Close Encounters, E.T., and War of the Worlds. That's at the $5 level, and I'm planning another one for that series. But I also did a pretty cool double feature that I did The Thing from Another World from 1951 and Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956. And that's going to be a part of an ongoing series of like five episodes where I'm going to be just kind of talking about Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Thing and movies like remakes of those and influence like movies that influence them. It's going to be a fun series. But anyway, check all that out. Patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. It helps me out a lot and it's a ton of content. I just recently upgraded the equipment a little bit. And so I've been really, really playing with the new piece of gear that I have. And Patreon has been reaping the benefits of that. So anyway, the shameless plugs out of the way, let me get into my thoughts and my review of A Piano in the House. So before I get to the actual plot summary, I'm going to say what I knew before going into A Piano in the House, and I knew nothing. In fact, I thought it had some kind of tie to Ray Bradbury, but it doesn't. I was getting that kind of, I wasn't necessarily getting it confused with I Sing the Body Electric. But I kind of thought that, because I know that that's the only Ray Bradbury story in The Twilight Zone, but for some reason I thought that A Piano in the House had some kind of connection to him. But it doesn't. And I assumed, judging from the title, that it involves a piano and a house. And I kind of thought maybe it's like an inheritance or maybe a haunted piano. Or a piano that plays specific music to remind the family of something. In any case, I definitely assumed that the piano in the title will serve as the Twilight Zone element or device in the episode. So I was off base, but not that far off base. The idea that it's a piano that plays specific music to remind the family of something is sort of close to what it is, but also I was going down a completely different rabbit hole. I was kind of thinking more along the lines of kind of more in style to Long Distance Call, like there being a something that is communicating from beyond the grave or something. But it's nothing like that, and I'm pleasantly surprised with it, honestly. We'll get into that as I get into the review, but for now, I'm going to go ahead and read the plot summary for A Piano in the House, courtesy of The Twilight Zone, Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic by Martin Grahams Jr. And of course, I'm going to be spoiling the entire episode from this point forward. So if you haven't watched it, go check it out and then come back and listen to my review. But fair warning, I'm about to spoil A Piano in the House. So here we go. Plot summary. Fitzgerald Fortune, a theater critic who takes pleasure in cruelty to his fellow man, visits a junk shop with the intention of purchasing a self-playing piano for his wife's birthday, a wife much younger than him, It only takes a moment for Fortune to discover the magical effect the piano has on other people when selected music roles are played. Believing that everyone has two faces, one we wear and the other we keep hidden, Fortune takes advantage of the guests attending his wife's birthday party. A young man reveals his affections for Fortune's wife, Esther. A fat woman imagines herself as the little girl she never was. The never-smiling servant laughs and cheers. Out of contempt, Esther switches the music sheets to throw the same ploy against her husband, who reveals that he's afraid of the dark. Fortune is nothing more than a frightened boy who hurts others because he envies those who embrace the world in ways he doesn't. He covets the talent of other playwrights, hurting them in his reviews. After having a brief taste of his own medicine, Mr. Fitzgerald Fortune loses the respect of his friends and his wife. Okay, so starring in A Piano in the House is Barry Morse as Fitzgerald Jerry Fortune. This was his only Twilight Zone episode, although he did appear in an episode from the 1980s Twilight Zone called Dream Me a Life. A couple notable credits in Barry Morse's filmography is one episode of Way Out, the short-lived sci-fi anthology series from 1961. And one episode of The Outer Limits in 1964, titled Controlled Experiment. And co-starring as Esther Fortune is Joan Hackett. This was also her only episode of The Twilight Zone. She had a couple of notable credits. One is that she appeared in an episode of Tales of the Unexpected that aired in 1985. And that was actually her last acting credit because she passed away of ovarian cancer in 1983. So, yeah, and, oh yeah, wow, that's sad, because she was actually nominated for an Oscar in 1982, the year before she died. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for the film Only When I Laugh. She lost to Maureen Stapleton, who won for her role in Reds. And then as Gregory Greg Walker is Don Durant. This is also his only Twilight Zone episode. The only notable credit I have for him is that he was the star of a short-lived Western show called Johnny Ringo. He played Johnny Ringo. And according to IMDb, he became disenchanted with Hollywood after his series, Johnny Ringo, was canceled and left the industry. He began a real estate and financial management company and became quite wealthy. So good for Don Durant. And then continuing with the cast, we have Muriel Landers as Marge Moore. This was her only episode of The Twilight Zone. And notable credits included a couple episodes of The Red Skelton Hour and Dr. Doolittle in 1967. And then rounding out the cast, we have Cyril Delavante as Marvin the Butler. This was his fourth of five Twilight Zone episodes. Previously, we saw him in The Silence, and next we'll see of him is in Passage on the Lady Anne. And another notable credit for Cyril Delavante is that he appeared in four episodes of science fiction theater, including the episode Postcard from Barcelona, which is the episode that I'm covering in the next episode of Anthology. So that's kind of neat how that kind of lined up a little bit. Writer for this episode, making his second of eight screenplays, teleplays for The Twilight Zone, is Earl Hamner Jr. Previously, we saw his work with The Hunt, and next we'll see from him is Jess Bell. And then rounding out the cast and crew is director David Green. This was his only Twilight Zone episode, and I don't really have much on him at all, but a couple notable credits that I did, like really the only notable credit I could find was he directed part one of the miniseries Roots. And his filmography has a ton of TV movies and miniseries. So, I mean, at least he had a pretty fruitful career, it seems. But only made one Twilight Zone. So, okay, talent rundown out of the way. Let me get into my thoughts on A Piano in the House. So this episode opens with the interior of a shop, like an antique store or a thrift shop, what have you. And it looks very similar in style and set design to the shop in The Man in the Bottle. Pizza's running around. She's got the zoomies and she is playing with toys. So ignore it if you hear it in the background. I'm so sorry. So we have Fortune walking into the thrift shop or to the antique store. And right at this moment, I just thought like, okay, this is clearly going to be like I kind of thought it would be something like the Chaser. Like he was probably going to go and buy something and then it was going to spell his doom, which is kind of correct, but it wasn't anything that the shop owner like created. Like it's not like he didn't go see Professor A. Damon to get the piano and everything, which I think works a lot for this episode because it is about Fortune. It's about Jerry Fortune and Fitzgerald Jerry Fortune, and about his just ugliness of character and his narcissism and just the horrible, horrible way that he treats people. So it makes sense that he, like, it works for the episode that he isn't given, like, the quote-unquote sort of monkey's paw kind of thing by someone. He is, like, actively seeking out a gift, and it just happens that the Twilight Zone is doling out the punishment to him. So he looks around and he can't find anyone in the store. There's this really cool shot of him looking in the mirror and then walking past it. And then the shop owner comes into view behind him in the reflection. And I just thought that was a really cool way to set up the shop owner. But also, I feel like it does feel a little bit disconnected from the rest of the episode, specifically because the shop owner isn't giving him the piano. He's not someone who is like an agent of the Twilight Zone giving out the element of, you know, destruction or punishment from the Twilight Zone to the offending character. So it just kind of feels a little bit like that one shot, as cool and unique as it is, it doesn't really have much emotional payoff or anything to the story. So yeah. So then Fitzgerald Fortune introduces himself to the shop owner and says that, "I'm Fitzgerald Fortune, the theater critic." And the shopkeep does not know him, does not really care to know him. And it's just immediately like, yeah, okay, cool. I don't really care that you're some big shot theater critic. Like, he doesn't say that, but his body language, his response, he doesn't respond with any air of respect or anything. And I find it interesting that immediately after that, Fortune just calls him a misanthrope. He says, "Oh, I thought I would come into this store and find, its treasures unlimited, but I found a misanthrope." Initially I thought that's kind of a quick judgment to cast on him, but I find it to be such an interesting hint on repeat viewings of the character of Fortune, because he makes that assessment specifically because of his sadistic narcissism. And what I mean by that is that the shop owner doesn't know who Fortune is. And since Fortune is in the center of his own little world, and everything that he can perceive revolves around him and his well-being, his importance, his perceived importance in the world. So he just assumes that because this man doesn't know who he is, isn't in his orbit, isn't showing him immediate respect, he's going to assume that the man is just a misanthrope and is going to be kind of contentious toward him. And I just find that to be a really interesting way to just signal to us in a very subtle way exactly what kind of character we're getting ourselves into with this story. So then Fortune says that he's there to look for a present for his wife's birthday. And this is where we get like our next hint, a much less subtle hint, of the character of Fitzgerald Fortune, because he says that he's looking for a piano, but because his wife wants to learn to play the piano, and he wants to get her a player piano, one that plays itself, because he just knows that she doesn't have any talent. So he figures, you know, I'll spare her that and just get her one that plays itself. And so it's just done, and like, it's so casual, where he's just like, yeah, she doesn't have any talent at all, so, you know, I might as well just get her something that isn't going to cause her to work toward having talent or anything, because I know everything and I can just have this player piano to, you know, maybe as a gag gift or whatever. It's just very, very, I don't know, it's so annoying to me in a good way, because it's a great display of just a disgusting character. So the shop owner says, "Yes, I have a piano. Let's take a look at it." And I immediately notice this, and I'm kind of sad that it doesn't really, like, it's not as focused, or it's not a focal point as the Mystic Seer thing, but the piano has like this little like sculpt head mast or whatever, this head sculpted into it, that looks kind of like a demon, sort of kind of devilish and intimidating, but it's kind of reminiscent of the Mystic Seer from Nick of Time. And I kind of wish that it was a little more prominent, because the Mystic Seer is such an iconic piece of the Twilight Zone that I kind of like the idea of having like another kind of devilish presence sculpted into the thing that is causing mayhem for a character. But then that would also be retreading things, so I don't know. But anyway, Fortune is talking to the shopkeep, and he asks how old his wife is, and he says 26. And the shop owner kind of chides him about the age difference, and he says something about youth and wisdom and everything, and how Fortune must have been quite charming to land a 26-year-old and everything. And I thought that that was really – that was a fun kind of – scene for the shop owner to kind of volley back at Fortune, who's already shown himself to be just a disgusting person. And so he says that that the piano is worth 250, but he'll let it go for 200 because it's a because it's for a birthday. And they demonstrate it, and he plays it, and his mood just changes. He gets very, very his spirit rises, and he talks about how it's great that, you know, there's that, you know, birthdays are a joyous occasion and everything. And then Fortune kind of calls him on it, and he's like, that's kind of weird. You sure are susceptible to the power of music. And then the shop owner is just like, isn't everybody? And I love that, because that is just telling us that, yes, everyone is going to be susceptible to this thing, to the magic of this Twilight Zone piece of equipment and everything. And because of that, it's going to cause doom, or it's going to cause some kind of peril for some character. It's going to cause hardship or a harsh truth to be uncovered and everything. So that's a good way to just kind of whet our appetite for it. So then the song changes, and the shop owner's mood just completely switches, and then he says that he doesn't really care about birthdays or anything. And so that's telling me, obviously, on my first viewing, that this episode is about a player piano that dictates the mood of the owner. That's not exactly accurate, because it's rather that it causes people to bare their souls with no inhibition, and to be able to speak freely and show their true selves. And I think that throughout the episode, I might bring it up later in the review, I'm not sure, but I think that there was a little bit of a discrepancy for me, because I didn't know if the style of music that plays dictates what type of truth that they would kind of cop to, or they would say or reveal about themselves, or if it was just that the music alone has the power to just kind of have them speak openly without fear of consequence or fear of retribution or ridicule or what have you. So they set up delivery, and then Fortune leaves the shop, and then that's when we get Rod Serling's opening narration, which I will go ahead and play right now.
Mr. Fitzgerald Fortune, theater critic and cynic at large, on his way to a birthday party. If he knew what is in store for him, he probably wouldn't go. Because before this evening is over, that cranky old piano is going to play those piano roll blues with some effects that could happen only in the Twilight Zone.
So I immediately, after hearing this opening narration, thought, okay, so this episode is going to be contained almost solely to the one night and the birthday party. And like, I just assumed that, and I'm pretty okay with that. I was pretty okay with that. I was pretty pleased with that, because there is such a unique kind of variety of characters that enter the party. So we'll get more on that later. But we come back from the break to an image of the piano with some very ominous and suspenseful music playing in the background, which made me wonder, is the piano itself evil? And it's not. I think that it's not, because it simply brings out what's inside people. So I kind of feel like that music sting at the beginning was a little bit of a misnomer for the episode. But Fortune arrives home, and he interacts with Marvin, the butler, who takes Fortune's coat, and Fortune just asks in such an aggressive and mean-spirited way. He asks Marvin just to that during the party he can't be so miserable. Like, he needs to, you know, not be miserable at the party, which is just so just cruel and just casually cruel. And then Esther enters the room, Esther being Fortune's wife, and she greets him, and just even then, like, Fortune just like says, like, hey, we need to fire Marvin because he's not working out. And he not even that they're that he's not working out. It's that he doesn't like Marvin's face. And it's just like doubling and tripling down on the cruelty of Fitzgerald Fortune is a really good way to just bring, like, continue this first act and lead us to the main crux of the episode, which is the comeuppance of Fitzgerald Fortune. So it also demonstrates that he just doesn't care who he's cruel toward. So then he asks Esther about the piano, and he starts patting himself on the back, saying that, you know, this is a thoughtful gift because I didn't want you to go through the trouble of taking piano lessons just to find out you have no talent. So, you know, this plays itself. It's a great, thoughtful gift. And, like, the lack of self-awareness and or just the casualness of his cruelty is really, really interesting to me at this point in the episode. And it made me very eager to see how he was going to be punished, because this is clearly leading toward a punishing kind of storyline. And it didn't disappoint in that regard. And then also, I kind of had like a little, prediction, I guess. I said that I really hope that the episode is about the piano turning everyone around and against Fortune, turning everyone around Fortune against him and serving him a Twilight Zone style comeuppance. And when I wrote that down, I was thinking more similar to the Chancellor at the end of The Obsolete Man to an extent, which we kind of get something like that, but more in a less vicious, less violently vicious, and more socially kind of devastating manner. So Fortune is kind of fiddling with the piano, and then this is where it also got a little bit confusing for me, because he says that the song he picked, it has a happy enough title to kind of test it out. And that's what made me think that this was like a Twilight Zone magic where the genre of music or whatever dictates the mood of the, you know, person listening to it. But that doesn't really seem to be the case per se. But regardless, he plays the music and Marvin starts grinning, and his mood just incredibly, drastically improves. And he talks about how he's happy about everything, and he speaks about how happy he is to be working and have money in the bank, and working for you is the best and everything. And I found this to be really interesting, because I had said that Fortune had little self-awareness, but he does have self-awareness, because he says that, he tells Marvin, like, there's no way you love your job. I treat you horribly. And then Marvin says, in like such a good way to set up the end scene, he says that he finds Fortune's tantrums hilarious. And he, like, when he's running around and he's throwing things and everything, it's all he can do to keep himself from laughing and everything. And that is such a great moment in this episode, still fairly early in the episode too, because it shows what other people's perception of Fortune is. When we have this character who is, by circumstance, by employment, and by the attitude of Jerry Fortune, he's kind of subservient of Fortune. And while in like everyday life without the piano and everything, all the power lies within Fortune, because he was just saying that we should fire him because I don't like his face. Like, all the power is within Fortune, but all the power that he has over Marvin, none of that can translate to respect, because Fortune is just such an ugly, despicable person. And I love that the piano just brings that out of Marvin. And also, the performance of Cyril, I can't remember his last name, Cyril Delavante, is phenomenal in this scene. He is extraordinary as he's kind of jumping around and just being extremely cheerful and energetic. It's fantastic, but it goes to another level, because it almost feels it almost feels like it's false. Like, it almost feels like the character is doing it entirely against his will, which is sort of true. Like, he is completely, like, his inhibitions are gone, and he's saying exactly what he's thinking, and that is horrifying. It's a horrifying thing to be forced to do against your will. And then also that kind of also made me a little bit more confused about the nature of the piano, because I didn't know if it was supposed to be have a hypnotic effect, or if it's like it kind of feels like a little bit too vague for me. But ultimately, I like the episode, so I'll let that slide. But it did feel a little bit ambiguous about the details of the manner of the Twilight Zone element. So anyway, Marvin's song ends and he gets up and just immediately switches back to that subservient sort of persona or attitude, I guess, demeanor. And he apologizes for speaking out of turn, and Fortune kind of laughs a little bit, like kind of, it's not even a mischievous laugh. He's just kind of like, it's okay. Like, it's totally okay. You're fine. And it's interesting because his mood has brightened, but then Marvin is just completely downtrodden, because he realizes like how much he stepped out of line without understanding why he stepped out of line. Whereas Fortune is delighted because Marvin was something of a test run, because he knew that the piano had some kind of magical effect, and so he needed to use it on Marvin to see exactly what was to come. And so Fortune gets down and he starts changing the piano, and he speaks about how he's always believed that people have hidden faces. You know, it's the face that they put out in the real world, and then there's that hidden face that shows like exactly who they are. And that is just classic narcissistic projection. It's like it is just really meaty character development, because it is that like classic like I am the center of my own universe, and I am the most important person on the planet because I am me and I don't care about anyone else. So my experience has to be the exact same as everyone else's experience, because I don't have the mental capacity or I don't have the empathetic gene to where I can be altruistic or empathetic or have any kind of empathy for anything, because everything centers around me. And the bottom line is always my enjoyment and how things affect me. So to have him just say like, yeah, this is what I believe about people. That's him real. Like, that's him saying like, this is what I'm experiencing. I have a hidden face. So everyone else must. It's really interesting kind of writing for a classic kind of narcissistic character. He then starts playing like this circus kind of music, I think, or this kind of upbeat tune. And that causes Esther to start speaking truthfully to Fortune. And she says that, you know, I gave you love but you couldn't reciprocate it. And you are just a very cruel, awful man. And I hate you. You take pleasure ridiculing me in front of your clever friends, and you're terrible. And again, I just really like this, because this episode has done such a good job so far of showcasing just how terrible Fortune is as like this just ugly, despicable character. But it's demonstrated that in such a variety of ways, like in his interactions with the shopkeeper, with Marvin's outburst, with Esther's outburst. And then it goes even further, because he talks about like he's like, oh, this is going to be so much fun to use at the party, because he's just completely completely uncaring of other people's, you know, personal boundaries and like their right to, you know, not tell him what they really think of him. So Esther says that she ends that kind of trance as saying that she hates him. And Fortune stops the piano and applauds Esther, saying that if she were in a play, he would give her a superlative review. And I really like the tongue-in-cheek way that the character who's just cruel and evil and despicable is a critic. Like, I feel like that is something that is just a lot of fun in terms of just like kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing for the Twilight Zone to play with. And so she is just kind of like shocked at herself for saying all of these things. And he just kind of deduces, yeah, it's the piano. You know, we're going to have some fun at the party. And she's like, no, you can't play the piano at the party, please. And at this moment, like in retrospect, I'm kind of curious if that is mostly because she wants to protect the secrecy of her affair with Greg, or if she's trying to protect Fortune from like being humiliated in some way. Like, what is it that she was that like compelled her to beg him not to play the piano at the party? And I think part of it, I think where I'm coming down on that is that she, maybe it's more cynical on my part, but my thought is that she doesn't want people's deepest desires, deepest thoughts to be said against their will out loud in front of Fitzgerald Fortune, because Fortune is a conniving, backstabbing, despicable, amoral person who would use that information and use what he learns from these people under duress. He would use that for his own personal gain, for his own amusement, and it would just up the cruelty of his attitude toward other people, his misanthropy, really, to just huge levels. And so I think Esther is trying to kind of protect the people around her, and also just doesn't want Fortune to have any you know, ammunition further than what he has now. But Fortune is in his own world, and he says that he is going to use it and that they're going to have the most amusing evening. And at this point, we're about to get an act break, and I felt like this was a really solid start to the episode, because we have, like I said, this amoral character in possession of something powerful that he's wanting to use for his own personal gain, purpose, and his own amusement. And in that sense, it's sort of similar to A Most Unusual Camera. But in that episode, the kind of oafish sort of criminals, they are using the camera for their own personal gain and greed and everything. Whereas this is just a despicable person using people for his personal amusement. And it's darker, and it's just more, I don't know, it's like, he's not bumbling in this episode. He is like conniving and just cruel. And it's definitely an interesting kind of dissimilar, or it's an interesting difference in the kind of overall idea of the episode that has some similarities to A Most Unusual Camera. And I just love that, to kind of end the act on that, I love that he had that gleeful sense of power. Like, he's just like, oh yeah, I'll have a very amusing evening with this. Because he's talking about the party, and specifically he's talking about using this thing, to put people into a trance so that he can just like steal their thoughts in a certain sense. And I don't know. I just really liked how he was gleeful in that moment, because I just knew like he is going to have some kind of punishment be doled out in the Twilight Zone. And I was very excited for that. Okay, so we come back from the commercial break, and the first guest to arrive is Greg, who immediately notes how Fortune is clearly in a very good mood. And they have this kind of little bit of sort of pretentious but kind of fun banter, where he's like, oh yes, I haven't seen is that your smile that you're wearing? And then Fortune says, oh yes, I took it out of cold storage in honor of Esther's birthday, ha ha ha. It's just very like pretentious and kind of annoying, but it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun banter, fun back and forth between these two men. Then Fortune kind of comments on Greg's bachelorhood and how he kind of assumed that Greg was a ladies' man. And at that point, I'm like, okay, yeah, I have a feeling that Greg is definitely having an affair with or has feelings for Esther. And so I was very happy that I was right about that. But anyway, Fortune then, to an unsuspecting Greg, plays like a romantic melody on the piano. And that's when Greg gets into his trance and he speaks lovingly about Esther. And he talks about this piece of jewelry that he gave her. And in this moment, he kind of reveals like what I think is maybe like a secret getaway he had with Esther, or maybe it was just the start of their affair that they, maybe he was speaking like truthfully when he said that they just happened to be in the same place, but it is very much implied that they had an affair and that they are having an affair. And to double and triple down on that, he says like, don't you realize that I am hopelessly in love with Esther? And then he says, and you don't even know her, like you don't know Esther. And then Esther comes in and kind of interrupts things. And Greg apologizes to her. And that's confirmation that they were having an affair. But Fortune has already known about it. And like, I like this because he says like, oh, yes, of course, I knew that you had an affair. I'm not stupid. The only thing that I didn't know was the details of your sordid little affair. I really like the kind of hoity-toity, kind of pretentious. I don't know what the word is. I think that there's some kind of word for that kind of like air of importance, accent or whatever. But anyway, it's really fun. But he says that he like didn't know the details about it, and what I really like about that is how that's kind of showing us the misery of Fitzgerald Fortune. That's showing us the misery of the character and how this misery is both a result of and a propellant of his cruelty. So it is like he is a cruel person, and because he lives in this misery and doles out this misery to others, it just amplifies that cruelty and the misery within him. And it's just, I don't know, it's just a really interesting kind of characterization to paint for Fortune. And then we get the arrival of the next party guest, and that's Marge. And I think the actress playing Marge, who I'm going to scroll up real quick, the actress playing Marge, her name is Muriel Landers. I think her performance in this episode is outstanding. I think she is really great. She gives a magnificent performance. The character is incredibly heartbreaking to me because she's overweight and she constantly makes these allusions to attempting to lose weight to no avail. And she is overcompensating with this self-deprecating humor that she's using as a defense mechanism. And part of me wonders if this is due to how casually untactful and how casually cruel Fortune is in everyday life, or if it's just insecurity on Marge's part. Either way, I find it incredibly sad to see her making a mockery of herself, presumably so that she won't be ridiculed one way or the other. And I think that that is such a tragic and sad, sad character trait. And I love later that she gets to lash out in her own way to Fortune, which I'll talk about in a bit. But so we got those characters set up. Now the party is in full swing. And again, Marge is constantly making those self-deprecating, self-effacing fat jokes. And at that moment, I'm like, okay, this is going to lead to a really sad moment for her. And that's going to be very sad and heartbreaking. But Fortune kind of quiets everyone down, sits everyone down, and he announces that he has a game and that he's going to use the piano as a game. And so he selects Marge as his guinea pig for the piano because there were no takers. There were no volunteers. And he just very excitedly puts the song in the machine and presses play, and it starts playing this kind of somber, kind of classical kind of thing. But she says, oh, my name's not Marge, it's Tina. I'm just a little girl. And like, again, it's a little bit confusing about what the actual properties of the piano is, because again, this leans more into the hypnosis sort of thing. But she says that she likes to dance, and Fortune tells her to dance. So she dances. Again, that hypnosis kind of thing. I don't really think that that works quite as well, since everything else is about kind of revealing their truth and revealing their secrets and everything. So to have her, like, dance for them is kind of, I don't know, it is an extension of the cruelty of Fortune, of course. But I don't know, I think that there's a little bit of, there's room for their, I don't know if, let me think of how to phrase that. There is a little bit, a slight bit of ambiguity to the finer details of the piano that I think could have used being fleshed out a little bit more. But she dances and everyone's laughing. And I noticed that Greg doesn't laugh. And I think that that's because he knows what's going on. Like he was under the effect of the piano. And so now he sees she is, and he knows that she's not doing it of her own volition. And so to go from there, she talks about how she's not always Tina. Sometimes she's a snowflake and light and beautiful and everything. And it's so sad to me because she's explaining her deepest desires to a room full of people that she is in, like, some kind of social circle with, and she has no control over what she's saying. She has no control, and that is just the humility aspect of that, and the way that it completely negates the quote-unquote other face that she has, to use Fortune's kind of logic, but the fact that it's just completely undermining this happy-go-lucky kind of self-effacing, joke-laden woman is just, it's all the more tragic because this is the deepest secrets that these people have, and it's really sad. So Fortune laughs, and just that alone, like the fact that he's using the people at the party in this way is so demented, and knowing that it's likely to get dirt on them, but also likely mostly due to just him wanting that experience and wanting that enjoyment because he finds enjoyment in others' like misery, is just so destructive and terrible and toxic. So it's fantastic. So Marge wakes up from the trance and then sits down, and it's just extremely sad. She looks sad. She looks very uncomfortable, and Fortune tells her to just cheer up and that it's only a game and that he chose her because she's so fun loving and easygoing and everything. Because anyone would be able to tell that she's using a defense mechanism with the jokes about her weight, but he doesn't, because he doesn't care to. He doesn't care about other people's feelings or anything. So overcompensating for Marge equals in Fortune's eyes, like, oh, she's game for anything. I can make fun of her. I can make her do whatever I want because I'm Fitzgerald Fortune. I'm important and everything. I don't know. So then he gives Esther a song to put into the piano as he gets up to get a drink, and she very slyly switches the song while he's gone. And so here's where the episode kind of, like, I don't know if this is a pacing issue, or I'm not sure exactly what the issue I have with it is, but I feel like at this point we've had two people at the party succumb to a trance that's enabled by the piano. And then now we're about to get kind of the big finish with Fortune being the one under the piano. But I kind of feel like the pacing is maybe not the best, because it feels like, so watching this a few times, each time I watched it, plus while talking about it here on the podcast, I get to this point and I'm like, there feels like there should be a lot more story left. It feels like there should be like another example or another kind of twist in the plot or another kind of thing to kind of bring us into like the third act, but there's really not. And I kind of feel like that something about it just doesn't really mesh well with me. But anyway, the other big thing that kind of didn't connect with me is that when Fortune comes back, he says that now we're going to reveal a devil in the party. And I feel like that comes about pretty suddenly. Like, that feels like that's not seated anywhere in the story at all. Because up until now, Fortune has just basically been doing it for his own amusement. And I think part of it is that narcissistic personality disorder where he thinks that everyone is as evil and despicable and disgusting as he is. But I kind of feel like him saying that he's ready to reveal a devil in the party, having no clue that it's going to be him, kind of feels like something that is introduced way too late in the episode. Like, I kind of wish that there was a scene or a line when he's talking to Esther before the party. Like, I wish that there was a line where he said something like, you know, there are devils among us and everything. And maybe that could be, like, that would be adequate to set it up, to set it up for the ending. But here it comes a little bit too late, because up until now, he's just been using it for his own amusement. He's been using it to have people reveal their deepest secrets to him, specifically because, like, Greg was having an affair with Fortune's wife, and because Marge, he knows deep down, he has to know deep down that she is insecure about her body. And so he did it, he didn't do it with any, like, he wasn't doing it with, like, oh, people are evil and everything. So when he comes back to this, it just feels like a little bit like the episode doesn't really graduate to that too cleanly. So he says, I think he says, now this is going to be fast. If there really is a devil among us, we shall know soon enough. And I guess it does make sense because, like I said, Fortune is a cruel man who thinks others are as cruel as him. So the hidden faces idea is him projecting the knowledge that he has this hidden person inside him, like this hidden face within him. And what he doesn't know is that his sadism is a character defect of his and not a common trait in decent people. And that's what he learns in this episode, which is fine. It's fine. I just feel like the devil aspect is kind of a little bit like it is. I don't know if it's supposed to be facetious or I mean, I know it's supposed to be hyperbole, but it just feels like him. He hasn't been seeking out like the ugliness of other characters. He hasn't been noticeably seeking that out. He's been doing it for his own amusement. So anyway, the music that Esther selected is a lullaby, which I heard is Rockabye Baby, but I think it's just called Lullaby. I'm not sure. But anyway, everyone looks up and we see, like, they see that Fortune is in the trance and Marge has just an amazing line where she says, she rises and she says, "Say something, devil." And it is like the delivery of that line is so perfect. And it's her acting on behalf of the Twilight Zone. She's acting as the Twilight Zone's proxy in doling out the punishment to the episode's villain. And I think that that is just so satisfying to me. And so so Fortune says that he's afraid, and Marge kind of, like, you know, encourages him to go on, and he says that he's afraid of the dark. And she says, "Well, you're not a devil, you're a poor frightened kid." And Fortune says, "That's a secret." And I love the delivery of that line because it is so vulnerable and fearful, but it is also clearly something that he's trying to restrain himself from saying. And I just love that, because as terrible and awful as he is, knowing, like, because he's terrible and awful, knowing that he's saying this against his will is kind of, in a messed up way, very satisfying, because again, it's his comeuppance, it's his just desserts, and it is just amazing. And so Greg then pipes in and asks him to tell them his secret. And he says, "I'm afraid of all of you. I'm afraid of people." And he says that he's kept a small frightened boy hidden inside himself. And because of that boy inside him, he just wants to hurt people. And then he goes on to admit that he envies Marge and he covets Greg's talent. And he turns to Esther and says that he's hurt her most of all because Esther's love for him frightened him, and he didn't know how to return the love except for in the way a small child would, by acting out and lashing out and everything. And it would be heartbreaking if I felt like the character deserved to have like a lesson learned moment, a eureka moment. But to be honest, he is so ugly and cruel and despicable that I don't think he deserves to have like to come out the other side. I think that this is absolutely a punishing storyline, a Twilight Zone punishment in a very interesting way. And there's a little bit of darkness that's lended by that, but I think it works really well, specifically because the character of Fitzgerald Fortune is just so despicable and disgusting. So the party disbands, and Greg asks Esther to leave with him, and Esther kind of pauses for a moment and then leaves with him, and that's kind of her making her choice. Everyone is disbanding, everyone's leaving, so Fortune is going to be alone, and he continues to just revert to being that small child. And like, this is a kind of a comical moment, but it's also just very, it's very much this fragile person just acting out. But he says, like, if everyone leaves, I'm gonna be very naughty. And just like the way he says that is just so infantilized, I guess, or like it's very much a childlike thing. But it is that desperation that I think is kind of satisfying for a villain character, again, getting his just desserts. So he throws a tantrum, he rips up the music, and I love that when the music stops, he continues on that tantrum. Like, his hidden face was his cruel face in the same sense. Like, he doesn't have a hidden face. Like, his hidden face is just the child within him and everything. But his, you know, his outward face is not something that should be celebrated anyway. So the episode ends with Marvin entering and the music stopping and Fortune telling Marvin not to laugh at him. And then Marvin looks at him with just like no respect whatsoever and says, I'm not laughing because you're not funny anymore. And I just love that, like, the world of this episode, the kind of social circle, the people around Fortune have so little respect for him, but also the fact that Fortune now knows how little they respect him and how little respect he deserves. Like, it's a dark episode for that mentality of Fortune. And I don't think, like, maybe it's very possible that I'm being very harsh on the character. But I think that in my own personal viewpoint, when someone is that just despicable and hateful and like, I feel like by design, this episode is not setting him up for a redemptive arc whatsoever. Because I don't think, and this is going to be very, very cynical, but I do not think that people that are that disgusting and despicable and hateful, I don't think that they have redemption within them. I think that it is incredibly unlikely that they'll change their ways. And I think that this episode really showcases that kind of very cynical, very, you know, negative kind of viewpoint that I'm spouting off awkwardly. But I think that it's warranted. I think that it's a punishment for him. It should be. Yeah. So anyway, then we get the closing narration, which I'll play right now.
Mr. Fitzgerald Fortune, a man who went searching for concealed persons and found himself in the Twilight Zone.
So overall, I did enjoy this episode quite a bit. I don't think it'll necessarily be like a top tier episode because it is a little bit ambiguous about the kind of the style of it. like the actual properties of the piano are a little bit ambiguous. And I also felt like the pacing was just a bit off. Like, it feels brief and brisk. And I feel like it could have used a little bit more polish in terms of setting up this, like, searching for like a devil within their midst, not like a literal devil, obviously, but like with him wanting to reveal people's ugly sides, their cruelty and everything that he has outward and has this sense of superiority over them because he is incapable of thinking of other people's like well-being or feelings or anything. So I kind of wish that there was a little bit more there. I wish it was a little bit tighter with that. But I do very much enjoy the character study of this episode and the cruelty and the seemingly heartless archetype of the character that is Fitzgerald Fortune. I think that it is a very fascinating character study for that. And I think that on that note, what I appreciate the most about this episode is that it's the way that the episode approaches the cruelty of the character, because he's expected to be the devil of the party. He's expected to be like the evildoer and everything, because that's what he is on the outside. But inside, he's a frightened child and everything. So it puts this very clear and easy to grasp image on this cruel character type without, and this is the key, without giving him the benefit of learning from his mistakes and becoming a better person for it. Because he already knows that he has these deep-seated insecurities, and there is a chance, like there is redemption that could be possible with that type of person, but the episode goes so far toward just pushing him over the edge, being cruel for cruelty's sake, that there's no hope of redemption. And wisely, the episode doesn't give him the redemptive arc. And I think that it works really well on that front, because the show is punishing, like the Twilight Zone is punishing this character for his cruelty and his heartlessness, and it's deservedly so. Yeah, so that's my review of A Piano in the House. I only have one piece of trivia, and that's that the original title was Won't You Play Me a Simple Melody. I don't really have much else on that, so let me know what you thought of A Piano in the House. And now I'm going to round out the episode with my thoughts on The Hastings Secret from Science Fiction Theater Season 1, Episode 29. So I'm going to play the stinger here, and when I come back, I will do a non-spoiler review for The Hastings Secret. So, The Hastings Secret originally aired on November 12th, 1955. The episode is available on dailymotion.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. The plot summary, courtesy of IMDb, is a team of investigators go to Peru after incomplete notes are sent from Dr. Hastings. They know he was working on new insecticides to use against termites, but when they arrive at the research station, they discover something frightening and revolutionary. This episode was directed by Jack Herzberg and written by Lee Hewitt. It stars Bill Williams, Barbara Hale, and Morris Ancrum. So like I said, I'm going to do non-spoilers for this, but the pre-show kind of demonstration that Truman Bradley does in this episode is that he shows a container with hydrochloric acid, and he stirs it with a glass rod. And when he takes it out, he shows that it dissolved, and then he uses a wood spoon and kind of comments on how it doesn't dissolve. And then he uses that as a demonstration to kind of connect it to termites and how termites eat wood and do all of this stuff or what have you. I don't know. But he talks about termites, and he says that that's what the theme of the story is. And so we get into the episode. And the thing that it is about, like it opens with a voiceover saying that, like, telephone poles are constantly under siege by termites and woodpeckers and stuff, and that there are scientists on the payroll that are paid to research termites and woodpeckers and to find out ways to get them to stop destroying our telephone poles and stuff. It's not as direct as that, but it's kind of fun. And so we learn throughout the course of this first act that there was mysterious research by Dr. Hastings, and there's been radio silence from his kind of lab outpost in the desert. And there's this really interesting demonstration of the solution that he sent back, like a liquid that he sent back that shows, like, they put like a clay kind of thing in a test tube, and then they pour the solution in it, and it, I think it changes into a solid. I'm not sure exactly what happens, but they comment about how, oh, it shows like an exact like molecular reorganization and stuff. And I just want to say, again, I've been harping on how just cool it is for the show to really like kind of lean into the science of science fiction. And this is another case of I'm just so, there's a warmth to the way that the show utilizes like lab equipment, like beakers and Bunsen burners and all of this stuff. Like it uses its props in a very engaging way that makes it not flashy. That I think is what it comes down to, is that it's not done in a flashy way. It is very authentic and realistic that these people would be doing these demonstrations in this, not even dry way, but just like this just natural way, because that's what they do. And I think that that just goes a long way to just really hammer home just the importance of science and the kind of discipline of it. And I just really respect this show for that. So they kind of talk about how Dr. Hastings is missing. And one of the characters is Dr. Hastings' daughter. The other one is a research guy who was hired. Oh, he's hired to, oh, I can't remember. He was hired for something. They decide to go to the outpost, to go to the desert where Dr. Hastings set up shop to research his stuff. And they find no sign of him. They see the tent and everything and all of that. What I found really interesting was that I am like 99% sure that that is the exact same location that they shot the ending of, I think it was last week's episode, the Uncovered or the un something, but, like the scene where, the character like kind of has their big, the Unexplored. No. I'm sorry. It was the Watermaker, I think. Yeah, I think it was the Watermaker. Anyway, whatever. One of those recent episodes, I think it's the exact same location. So they kind of are looking for Dr. Hastings. They're seeing all of these clues and everything. And I really liked this aspect of it, because they find like his spare glasses and then they find his regular glasses. And they're like, oh, like his daughter's like, no, there's no way that he would have left without his glasses. Something is wrong here. And they are looking at his research and trying to figure stuff out. And then the way that they kind of discover where he is, I'll stop at that point. I'm not going to say like what they discover, but the way that they discover what like the location is really cool, because they notice that there is like radio interference, like their radio signal is being like there's something interfering with it. So they set up equipment to kind of triangulate where that interference is coming from. And it's just really cool. It was really cool. And so they find out that it's within, like, inside this cave. And so they have to go down, which is where, like, I do feel kind of bad. Or kind of, I don't know, I feel sort of bad. Somewhat dogging the episode for using the same setting. Because this is pretty cool. Like, this was a pretty cool scene. Like, they show them going into, like, a little, like, valley of the cave or whatever. And there's like an interior set in there, and it's really well done. It's really well done. But that's where they find the answer that they're looking for. They find like what happened to Hastings, and what they find is like kind of crazy. Like, it's kind of messed up, and I kind of respect the show for going for it for that. Like, I thought that was pretty neat. But that gives the characters like a renewed respect or a renewed drive to further the research and everything. And it ends on a very happy note. There's also a very unnecessary like kiss at the act break between the researcher and Dr. Hastings' daughter. It just feels like, oh, we need something. We need to add something for you know, to get like the housewife demographic, or to get like teenage demographic or something. I don't know. It just felt a little bit just superfluous. But overall, like, I thought it was okay. I thought it was a solid episode. It was totally fine. And I don't usually have trivia for science fiction theater. I'm really excited to say this. So I do have an interesting piece of trivia for this episode of science fiction theater, if you guys will bear with me for just a moment. The only thing I could find was that it's interesting to note that this episode of science fiction theater, it aired the night of a high school dance in the town of Hill Valley, California, where noted science fiction author George McFly had his first date with his future wife, Lorraine. And it's interesting to note because he was apparently hesitant at first to go to this dance, specifically because it was the night his favorite TV show, Science Fiction Theater, was on. Apparently he has said that, you know, some stranger, like, kind of coerced him into it or convinced him to go to it. So it's just really interesting because he, you know, he loves his wife, and this was the episode that he missed in order to go to what the school would call the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. So that's neat. And also worth noting, just a little piece of Hill Valley history, is that that night there was also a very bad thunderstorm. And during that thunderstorm, a bolt of lightning struck the clock tower in the town square, and kind of just permanently damaged the clock tower. And there were also, I found some reports of these two, like, unexplained lines of fire on the road, almost like tire tracks, but flaming tire tracks, that were never explained. And so that's pretty weird. And then I guess a few decades later, the Hill Valley Preservation Society fought to keep the clock tower intact as a historical landmark, and as far as I know, they succeeded. So it's a historical landmark. I've been waiting so long to, like, ridiculously long to do that bit. If you by any chance don't know what I'm talking about, Back to the Future, it's amazing. So anyway, that's the only piece of trivia. Finally, like, one of the main reasons why I chose to cover science fiction theater, the reason why I was excited to get to own the DVD collection and everything, was that I was excited to get to this episode because of that one line of dialogue in Back to the Future. Yeah, I'm just delighted by that. I'm gonna actually try to find the clip where he says that, just to kind of end the episode on a fun note there. So here is the clip of George McFly lamenting that or saying that he can't go to the dance because of science fiction theater.
Regret it for the rest of my life. But I can't go to the dance. I'll miss my favorite television program, Science Fiction Theater.
Yeah, but George, Lorraine wants to go with you.
Okay, so yeah, I just had to share that. Okay, well, that'll be it for this episode of Anthology. So glad I could finally hit that milestone. I'm so happy about that. So anyway, I will say in conclusion about this episode of Science Fiction Theater, I'll be honest, I don't think George McFly really missed out on all that much. Like, it's fine. It's an okay episode. The kind of conclusion that they reach with the reveal of what happened to Dr. Hastings is very interesting. But other than that, the episode is kind of dry to me. But anyway, all right, well, that will do it for this week's episode of Anthology. A little bit late. I was expecting to get this up on Thursday, but just time got away from me. So you guys are getting it Saturday, but I'm hoping to have the next episode, which will be episode 87, where I cover The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtlebank and Postcard from Barcelona from Science Fiction Theater. I'm hoping to have that up on time next Thursday, and Patreon supporters at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer will have early access to it So consider signing up on Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. And even if you don't, I do recommend checking out Dark on Netflix, because I'm very late to the party, but it is very cool and very science fiction-y. And I'm very, very happy with it. So check that out. But without further ado, thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.
And now, here's a short clip from our Patreon-exclusive RSS feed. To hear the full clip and more exclusive Patreon content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and become a patron at the minimum rate of $1 per month. Thank you and enjoy.
And then we get the date, November 5th, 1986. And I put in all caps just a string of ha's. And I put in all caps, November 5th. I just realized that it's November 5th. That's the day Doc Brown invented time travel and Back to the Future. I love that as an Easter egg. I absolutely love that. And I was just so floored by that. Yeah, I'm just so excited about that, honestly. That's just so awesome. God, that is such, it's such a delight. It's such a delight. So I love that. So anyway, kind of to wind down.
This podcast was edited and produced by Matt Hurt and presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. You can find links to all of our shows at ObsessiveViewer.com/podcasts. For exclusive bonus content, including reviews, commentaries, and B-roll episodes, you can subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/ObsessiveViewer. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.